Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
We talk about it at conferences and discuss it over coffee. We should get institutional investors, the pension funds, the insurance companies, and the very large asset managers investing in this space. But very few people have actually raised from these players and thought about their role. Today we are joined by someone who has done just that and plans to raise a lot more and put it to work. As the early stage space is slowly getting crowded, luckily, we need to start thinking about who can write $100 million or euro checks to give the scale-ups in the region, ag and food tech space, the time to really grow. And we discuss why now is the moment for regenerative food and ag as healthcare costs are getting out of control, institutional players are forced to invest in impact, technology and raw computational power make almost magic possible, and most importantly, the enormous influx of talent focusing on food, ag and soil. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below.
Welcome to another episode. One that's been a long time in the making. I can say friend of the podcast, or a follower and supporter as well, which obviously I want to thank Eric for. I've been following the journey of Eric and Astanor and also Qualia for a long time. We had Qualia many, many years ago. I think it was the first 30 episodes or something. But I really wanted to have Eric on to explain a bit of his journey into this fascinating world of impact investing and then even deeper into food and ag. So welcome. Thank you for hosting us as a podcast in your office with a magnificent view on the city of Brussels. And I see some wind turbines turning. Not so many farms, but probably if I look far enough, I can see some. But welcome on the podcast and thank you for making time.
Thank you very much, Koen.
And to start with a personal question we always love to ask, why soil? With all the career paths you could have chosen, I would say after your time in Silicon Valley, like you could have gone 100 different routes. How did you end up in the world of food, ag, farming, and not the easiest path, let's say, and impact investing?
Well, impact investing is something I've been, you know, growing into for over 15 years now. But what led me to soil is more like food that led me to soil. One is I'm definitely a big foodie. I got involved in a number of food related projects, personal projects, including investing in a few restaurants. Not because of the trying to make money. You never make money in the restaurants.
Listen to this. If you're at the curve of investing in a restaurant for the money reasons, step back and think of it as a hobby, because statistically, you're not going to do it.
You're not going to make money. Even in the best restaurants, at best, you're going to get your money back. But I was very fortunate to meet a few chefs that were really inspiring in their, you know, their vision of the need to change our approach to food, and that led to in the supply chain to where this food came from, and working with a few scientists also, again being you know I became close to one of the chefs in very well-known chefs in London called Jamie Oliver, who through a series of evolution in our relationship asked me at some point to become chairman of his foundation for food education, which was mostly working with kids. And I discovered the really deep problems of our food system, which has been, and I've said that a couple of times before, but has been developed over the past 70 years to deliver very efficiently cheap calories throughout the world, but not cheap nutrients. And in doing so, we have been producing huge problems on the health side. So people are being, they develop all kinds of metabolic diseases, especially diabetes type 2, that should not exist in the world, but unfortunately does exist, and it's touching more and more people. In the US, it is estimated today that 30% of people who are born after 2000 will have developed diabetes type 2 by 2030. So, you know, this series
of... Which is tomorrow, basically.
It's tomorrow. It's huge. And the other number which I wanted to give before I go back to the soil is that, which is a really scary number. Today, Americans spend $1.1 trillion on food every year. And by a little bit by coincidence, but definitely it's linked, the healthcare system in the US spends $1.1 trillion, the same amount of money, to cure the diseases that are caused by the poor nutrition of people. And we're talking mostly about diabetes type 2.
Plus then another...
$1.1
trillion. Yeah, another two times that amount. I think there was a Rockefeller study, yes, on true cost accounting. The cost of the food system just in the US is three times what... Right. The U.S. population spends on it. So it's the health and then two times environmental and social.
Exactly. And then I get to the soil.
So it's four, basically. 4X.
No, it's 3X. So 1.1 spent on the food by the consumers. 1.1 spent partly by the same consumers, partly by the state to deal with the healthcare issues. And 1.2 trillion spent that is not being accounted for really today, but is the cost to the environment, including the soil, a lot to the soil, biodiversity, environmental, and so on. And so it all starts with the soil. It all starts with the fact that we have been growing monocrops.
But do you remember when that clicked? I mean, you started with food and of course, the connection with these chefs to soil. But do you remember, was there one moment,
yes,
or multiple, when you were like, whoa, it all starts with soil. Like, this is not just on the taste, but also actually on the environmental piece, which is for me, it was a big shift going from, of course, if we eat better food, it's better quality, better taste, better paid for farmers, et cetera, et cetera. But to see the switch to water, carbon, biodiversity, like, it literally all starts with the soil, was quite an eye-opener for somebody who didn't grow up on a farm. Was that the same for you? Was it a natural, to see the potential of the issues and the potential of soil in these all these areas on health, carbon, water, biodiversity?
So as I said, you know, I didn't grow up in a farm. I didn't study. I spent quite a bit of time now with scientists from UC Davis, from Van Eynigen, from other places on agri now. But at the time, I was really new into that space. So I came from this food side, being really aware of all the things around corn and high fructose corn syrup, all the things that I got into, trying to understand these monocultures and how, including in Europe, the monoculture, which is sponsored by the subsidies, to keep this statu quo, where you basically have a system that you keep subsidizing not just the farmers, but the system that brings all the, all the insurance that you have to put in the soil. And the soil becomes just a very dead substrate. And the aha moment on the soil itself goes entirely, the credit goes to my friends at Sol Capital. So I became at that time, at the very beginning of Sol Capital, Chuck came to me. I became the first private investor in Sol Capital because I really believed in the vision of Chuck. And he took me to Frédéric Thomas' farm in Sologne. And Frédéric Thomas showed me the difference between his soil, was using regenerative agriculture, and the soil of his neighbor, who did not see the point of using. I think today he still doesn't see the point, the neighbor, because he gets all the subsidies, you know, to do
Why
things.
Would you? Yeah.
And suddenly it was the aha moment when Frédéric started to dig in the soil and showed me the difference in the soil between the two. And everything clicked together. You know, I'd read a number of books on the invention of synthetic fertilizers and all these things. And then suddenly I saw that. It was very abstract until then. And that very moment was the famous aha moment where I said, geez, you know, there's something to be done here. And I started to dig in, you know, whether there would be a number of technologies that could be developed and or sponsored for that. And that was by serendipity. I didn't meet because I already met her before, but this very famous scientist in France who happened to have a summer house next to my summer house in France.
Serendipity.
Dr. Pascal Cossard, who is the Secrétaire Perpétuelle de l'Académie des Sciences. So she's like the chairwoman of the French Science Academy. So, you know, someone fairly knowledgeable. And she's the person that actually discovered the role of listeria and the you know, how listeria goes from cows to the soil back to the cows and everything, and how things... There's a link between the microbiome of the soil and the microbiome of the animals and people. And until her research in the 1990s, people did not really understand that there was a microbial life on the soil because it's anaerobic, which means that as soon as you bring it to
a lab,
the lab, it's dead. So you don't see anything. You say, okay, you know what? We don't have to worry about it. Just put NPK and everything will be fine. So her work, or pioneering work with listeria, gave birth to all the things we've been looking at. And it was a very new field of understanding the microbiome of the undersoil.
And you were discussing that in front of your summer house.
Yes.
You happened to talk about gardening maybe and soil. You discovered that she was...
And fishing,
and that she was that key figure, or...
Yes, yeah. And... I said, wow, you know, this is a signal. You know, I have to do something about that. So between the, you know, visit to Frédéric Thomas, then a few weeks later, my discussion with Pascal, and I thought, you know, this is fascinating. You know, things are happening right now. There's a new sector. There's a new potential revolution. And then my friends in Silicon Valley, around 2009, there was a big breakthrough in deep learning. Okay, so the first company I started as a CEO and co-founder was one of the first deep learning company, but way too early. It was very frustrating. We didn't have enough computing power. We are dealing with single layer neural networks.
Shallow learning, yeah.
Shallow learning, single layer neural networks, very slow. It was a bit frustrating from that point of view. And then my friends the people I hired in my company, fresh out of universities in the early 90s, where by then senior or even senior engineers or even managers or directors of data mining in the big companies at Google. And so a friend of mine actually was the head of search for Google and working on all the things. And then, you know, some people who worked for me ended up being the head of data mining for Amazon and for Twitter.
So
and
good, things. A good birthplace for many careers.
Yes, exactly. But they were reporting to me with a lot of excitement this breakthrough in artificial intelligence. And I kind of say, maybe, you know, there's something to be done between, you know, applying that to, so basically what has become today, you know, synthetic biology and all these things. So I started to look, and I found that there were quite a few people working on that already, starting to work on that. So I said, okay, you know what? This is happening. There is a big breakthrough, a combination of AI and biology. That's going to change. It will eventually change the way we look at agriculture. It's going to be changing the way we have been looking at things. We have been making very important simplifications that are not correct anymore. You know, agriculture is not linear. It's not NPK gives life. It's much more complex than that. And now we have the means from a, you know, computing capacity to actually have much more complex models that will lead to a new order in the way we look at things. So it's a very high level kind of thinking.
Yeah, but it's a fundamental question that I think investors like yourself as well ask, okay, why now? Like we knew, or there's been reports coming out on the poor quality of soil and it's going down, and of course books coming out for the last 20, 30, in some cases if you go back with David Montgomery to 100 years ago, I mean, the early organic pioneers in the UK did observe science, but still saw the connection between healthy soil and other things. And we still went on the path of 70 years of extremely intensive extractive ag and food. So why now is it different? And the underlying answer in your case seems, and there's a huge breakthrough in computing power, which enables 10,000 other things, or we cannot even imagine yet. And so you said, okay, I'm not going to continue, or maybe you can, of course, continue part of that in my foundation work and NGO work, but I see an opportunity here to apply my VC and my Silicon Valley knowledge into this new world and apply this breakthrough into ag and food. Was that already, was it a logical step? Like you from those few weeks of these serendipity encounters, was it a very logical step to found Astanor? Or like what happened between you? Like, okay, this could be a massive investment opportunity, or it has to be, and it should be, and then let's build that. Compared to many other paths you could have chosen, like invest in some of these or set up a foundation to push against corn syrup or to push computational and deep learning. Like what was that click to, okay, we're going to build an investment house, like quite a substantial one, we'll talk about that, and to invest in this space, because there's the why now is now.
I think it is... it's exactly what you described, was this aha moment that I said, okay, there should be something happening. But quite frankly, there was enough naivety in my thinking. I didn't know enough about the sector to to think, okay, it's going to be so difficult, I shouldn't do it. I think if I had been a deep expert in the area, maybe I would have said, you know what, I'm going to stay in what we didn't call metaverse at the time and do gaming. But the thing that really pushed me into that is I'd been fairly schizophrenic for a while, making investments in companies that were making money, whether they were social networks or Spotify or whatever at early stage, fascinating, work to be a venture capitalist is really great. And I'm super grateful I've been able to do that for a long time. And when companies actually do succeed in becoming big companies...
You might be listening to this through Spotify. Exactly. As a podcasting player, yeah, but there was something itchy.
Yeah, it's fascinating to do that. But at the same time, schizophrenia came from the other side of my work. Non-for-profit was to, work with social entrepreneurs, which were not very scaling. They were not scaling for the most part. Actually, all of them, none of them were really scaling when you think about it. And then I saw the possibility of doing the two things together. And that gave me a boost of energy, maybe I can do something which is meaningful, which is really fun, and making money at the same time. So that making money is very, very important, because it gives you the sustainability, it gives you the attractiveness of working with more and more investors, and really have the potential maybe one day to have a systemic impact, and which is really what I've been aiming for? Can we, as a firm, have a systemic impact on the planet? Of course, we're not going to change the entire planet, but can we have, you know, for some parts of the system, can we really change it because of some of the investments we've made, some of the risk we took, some of the conviction we managed to bring to others? And that's really exciting, and much more than making money for the sake of making money, and much more than giving money to a charitable organization that, you know, you feel good about it, but you know that it's not going to change the world.
And so what was the original idea of Astanor? Because you went big. You didn't go for, let's raise 10 or 20 million and put that to work. You really went for, and we're going to unpack that as well, to go after, maybe not with the first fund necessarily, but definitely with the follow-up ones, to attract institutional capital. Was that from the beginning your conviction, we need to go? I mean, I'll ask the $1 billion question, but you're pretty close to that. You're going to get very close to that. Like, was it from the beginning, okay, we need to move lots of zeros and not just a few to move the needle? Or is that something that happened because the wave started to roll as well, and you managed to serve it quite nicely?
Right. Yes. You know, 20 years of venture capital prior to Astanor, and a bit more for my co-founder, George Coelho, more like 30 years in his case before we started Astanor, had taught us that, you know, money matters and amount of money matters in this business. Why does it matter? Because of what we do. We do things that require high conviction for a while. Well, high conviction, what I mean by high conviction is, there are several ways of practicing venture capital. One is you just follow, you know, the trend, or you follow some people who are doing things, and you put money following those people. And statistically, if you have good investors in front of you, you don't have to have a lot of conviction. You just have to be, to be convinced in a way that those people know what they are doing. So I'm not going to give you names of firms, but, you know, everyone knows.
Following,
you can follow those firms and you'll do well. And you don't need to have yourself a lot of conviction about the sector or the companies or the people that you're working. There are times where it takes a while for a company to really take off, to really go through a certain amount of time where, you know, things are going to look pretty bad. I mean, take Amazon, you know. It took quite a while for this company to become the powerhouse it became. It lost money for a while. And so investing in such companies, I'm not talking about, you know, Amazon is not...
You need to have the stomach to stay.
Exactly. You need the stomach. But you need to have the conviction that between the idea, between the timing, the idea, the product market fit, and very importantly, the management team, which you may have to augment, or you may have to do something about it, which is what we do most of the time, you know, is help. In one way or another, we help bring new people into that. That's, you know, you are going to be pushed by a lot of people around you saying, I don't believe in that. I don't understand how you can believe in that. I don't understand how you can have put money into that company. I don't see the future. This is a big mistake, and so on. But if you are really convinced of that, you have to have the staying power to do that. So if you have a really small fund and you're going to be, you know, pushed away by other people, or you're going to be washed away, or you won't be able to put the resources to sustain this company that for a while. So that's what we thought from the beginning. You know, eventually we need to have that that power to back our convictions. It took not much longer. It was much shorter than we thought. So, the first fund that we wanted to raise, we had a very small fund that was more like us and a couple of friends. But the first fund we wanted to raise, we thought, you know, maybe we'd be 100 million, and And then we'll have another one. And then it turned out to be pretty much 300 million. So that's
three times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the next one, which
I remember a chat we had at that time, you said, we raised a bit more than we expected, which is good. But it's also a challenge because, of course, you have to put it to work. It's not that you can leave it on a bank account. I mean, for a while, because you can follow your convictions, etc. But your investors expect you to put that away. So what made you decide to not put a hard cap at 150 or 200 and call it a day and go for the and take the 300? Was it a conscious? I mean, of course, it's a conscious decision. But like you were like, okay, actually, I can see the deal flow and the quality for even that amount. So let's do it.
Yes, I mean that's the latter actually. When we started to look at the sector and made a few personal investments around 2015, 16, you know, at the very beginning, there were very few projects that made sense. You know, we invested in agri economy at the very beginning of agri economy. I mean, companies like that, but which now just raised a big round of financing.
60 million.
But there were very few entrepreneurs that were having a combination of vision, a level of ambition that match our desire to have a systemic impact, and the technology breakthroughs, the product.
Is that a fundamental one for you, that it has to have that breakthrough piece you mentioned before that happened around 2009 at the core somewhere at the core, because otherwise it won't scale fast enough? Would you say most of your companies have that somewhere?
Yes, for the most part, yes. I mean, virtually all of them. But the technology breakthrough is not necessarily AI breakthrough. It could be something. Most of the time now, by the way, it is linked to biology in one way or another. And if it's not biology, it might be mechanical, like Monarch tractors, but linked to a way to deal with the soil in a very different way. Yeah? Because if you can pinpoint very precisely where to do things in the least intrusive way and be very precise in what you are going to put in the soil, that's a big breakthrough from that point of view.
And is time and the normal, let's say, VC time frame of a fund, we've discussed it many times on the podcast, that it's not it's tricky, let's say. It's difficult, or it's a challenge, the speed of which returns are required and the speed of which does these companies have to scale and grow, etc., which we need for the planet. Let's not discuss that, because, of course, it's not we can wait 20 to 30 years because that's way too late. But the 7 or 8 or 9 years, do you see that was designed for Silicon Valley and software, most of it, and maybe part of hardware? Have you experienced that as a challenge for, let's say, the food and ag tech space to, like, we need these returns relatively fast and we need to put 300 million to work? Is that been a puzzle and thus a challenge? Or you said, actually, there's enough deal flow that can do that. And we are convinced that also with the normal VC, the traditional quote-unquote VC methods and structure, we can actually, we can make a meaningful dent.
That's a very good question. I don't think we have a full answer to date, but you're right. It's not just about agri-food. It's also about other sectors that require longer time than... If you develop an antivirus software, you push a button and you have a billion antivirus software that are being pushed to customers. If you grow insects in a vertical farm, you push a button,
and then
it takes 9 months for the
thing to... Which is fast for
is fast.
Animal protein. Yeah.
And then another year for that and so on. So it takes... You have to deal with nature, and nature has seasons, and nature deals with things at certain speed. Even if you can incredibly accelerate, thanks to AI and computing power, for example, the selection of new species or new variety of plants that correspond to a certain level without doing gene editing necessarily, just looking at the acceleration of that today with AI, you can go from 12 years to a year.
But still, It's a year. Not, yeah, and it's not three days. Yeah.
But that's why I meant initially about the breakthrough.
So did you tell your investors, like, look, this is not your typical SaaS Series B, this could take, or did you build something in to make it, to give you a bit more time, or was that tricky in the first
place? It's a tricky thing. Eventually we'll get there. But you're right, you have to remind our investors, for the most of them, that it takes time. So every year we remind them that it takes time. Because it's human, you know, you put money somewhere and you're antsy. You say, okay, I want my money back.
Yeah. And they might go through that J curve and the difficult years. And now with Fund 2, are you doing things differently, or is it mainly same investment thesis, bigger, obviously, or are there structural things you do differently?
I think we have built a team, so there's a difference between what we are doing at the very beginning. You had two guys in the garage making small investments, and now we have more of a professional team with about 35 people that are on two continents, and so it's a very different process. But we really work hard on is to keep that pioneering spirit of, every single deal is the most important deal we are working on, and every single company we have invested in is the most important company that we have ever invested in before. And keeping that, I would call that, almost animal spirit, especially in the case of agri-food, is very important. So we are not, I think we are not, complacent or anything like that. We think that it's just the very beginning. I mean, this transition is going to be unfolding for the next 15, 20 years at least in front of us. And so we're just at the very beginning of what's going on.
And what has changed, or has something changed, of the appetite of investors, like the conversations you have now compared to 2017, 18, and when you were raising the first fund? Has that changed? Are the institutional ones, the larger pockets, are they finally coming? What has been in a very challenging environment we're in now? Obviously, yes. We're recording this in November 2022. What is your feeling of the markets, or also of the second fund? Is it going to be? Is there more interest and also commission to actually put significant amount to work? I mean, you already raised 300 million almost, so significant definitely, but you're targeting a considerable larger one. What has been the response from investors?
So it's interesting because this year, not surprisingly, private investors, especially, and smaller family offices are much more cautious about making long-term illiquid commitments. There are a number of endowments and pension funds that have rules, prudential rules that make sense because of the disbursement. University endowments need to be able to disburse to students that need bursaries. They need to do things with research. Same for pension funds. They need to be able to. So they have ratios of public equities, which are liquid, to private equities. And because of the collapse in the value of public equities, suddenly the value of private equities have gone up. And for them, many of them totally stopped the new commitments in private equity, which includes venture capital. So that's a little bit of a challenge. On the other hand, what we are seeing for the first time is that the really large asset managers, the big insurance companies, the big multi-asset managers, have a mandate or political pressure, depending on which countries they are in, to invest in impact investing. But being big institutions, they are looking for big tickets. That's why they have invested in some of the very large
TPG
KKR, and so on. But now they're looking
at tickets are 100, 50, 200? Yeah,
it's very difficult for many of them to put less than 100. For some really, really large one, it's like 500 minimum. And then the smaller one is 50 plus, you know. So, but we are seeing them suddenly because we have been growing recently in our fund size. And we are Article 9, 9.3, which is very rare in terms of investment. So it's the SFDR taxonomy to say that we are real impact. Because a real impact feels like Twitter blue. Well, real impact.
You bought your blue, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
It was $9.99 per month. Yeah.
Exactly. So we, thanks to that, now we are Article 9. But, and that's, you know, there are not that many places where those people can invest. So suddenly we see a lot of interest, at least theoretical interest for now. But I think it's good news for all of us who are working sincerely in that sector, that are genuinely investing in impact investing for the agri-food space. There is a handful of funds that that are doing that at a certain size. And I think it's very important that we have that power to invest in later stage investments that are not just seeds, that are not just Series A, but we can go at a higher level because those companies will need sustained power because, you know, they are changing the world. It's not going to happen overnight. They will not be profitable overnight. And that, again, requires high conviction. We have a lot of colleagues, venture capitalists, who are dealing at the lower amount level because it's earlier stage. They are doing a fantastic job of nurturing those companies. There's not enough money going into the next stages, you know, the growth stage. The growth not in the sense of what people are doing today with more mature industries. These are still pioneering industries. And if it takes another 5 years for a company to be profitable or another 3 or 4 years, it's really difficult to find today that to fund that gap.
10, 20 million to go or more.
Yeah,
or
more. Probably more, like 100 million. How do you find that today is a challenge for many companies. So we think, you know, this new interest from the very large asset managers for this type of impact fund, some of them, like ours, will be, you know, channeled to the agri-food space. This is key for the sector to get there, because otherwise we won't be able to fund this transition.
And what would you tell, like, the private investors that are holding back a bit now? Let's say we're in a theater and it's a room full of private investors and the smaller endowments and family offices. What would you tell them? Obviously, we're not giving investment advice, but what would you like to leave when they leave the room, when they leave the theater? What should be the thought on their mind? Where should they go and dig a bit deeper? Or where should they go and understand more of this space? What is a good place to start?
As you said, we don't want to give investment advice, certainly. I think the first thing to really realize is regenerative agriculture is going to happen.
Because, you like it or not. Yeah.
Because there's no choice. The good news is what we are seeing right now is you have thousands of really bright entrepreneurs who were not thinking about that before. They were not thinking about, you know, about regenerative agriculture. They were not thinking about biology that needs to be developed. They didn't think about mechanical engineering that needs to be developed, about big data that needed to be developed for regen ag to become really the mainstream.
Do you see the deal flow now
Yes.
coming? Like, do you see also a shift in, like, the investments Astanor has been making? Like, is it getting more into the ag space or the regen ag space, or has it always been food plus ag, or has it been like the themes, have they been shifting over the years of investing and thus going forward?
I think initially the low hanging fruits were more on the food side, you know, because it made a lot of sense and so on. Ag, we have been trying to do things around that. But there is some fundamental data plays that need to happen for Region Ag to be on par in terms of profitability from a farmer's level point of view. The other thing is farmers don't have the money to invest in that. So it needs to come from something else, or we need to have the means to point them into a new process, new form. So the good news and the bad news is there is a huge generational transition happening everywhere in the Western world when it comes to farmers. So the numbers vary between, 50%, 75% in the next 10 years, 15 years in the US, in Canada, in Western Europe. There would be new farmers. Existing farmers will need to retire or will retire. And then someone needs to take over. So the bad news is a large proportion of the children of farmers don't want to become farmers because they've seen the progressive destruction of lifestyle that this current generation has had. They had a great time, regardless of what they were using in terms of techniques and products, everything, until recently, but they have been going down now. And we might be able to, as a society, I'm not talking about us two here on this table, but we might be able to attract people back into a new form of farming because of technology, because of data-driven decisions and so on, that will make farming much more livable. I'm not even talking about, but you'll be, if you can be in the countryside, in nature every day, if that's something you are really attracted to, and you don't have to break your back, you don't have to work, 90 hours a week to make barely minimum wage and even less, that's not very attractive. But if you can do something better than that, if you can actually have a business model that makes sense. So we have been working with Hectare in France and Audrey Bourleau. She has done a fantastic job at modeling, what it takes to make farming again an attractive position. An attractive career proposition. And I think this is the important thing to realize is we are getting to the point where what we see in terms of technologies everywhere, new technologies, new processes, is likely to make that happen. So there are a number of companies out there that are just starting to grasp what needs to happen and what needs to be delivered to the farmers, to the companies that are buying from farmers, which is very important, the ecosystem, companies that are selling to farmers. So all this ecosystem needs to adapt. And to me, looking at the trends and the willingness from a number of people to push that evolution, I think it's going to happen. So, message is
it will happen.
It will happen, and there are already some really interesting companies to invest in.
So the choice is: you want to be part of the journey or not? And are you optimistic? You said it's going to take 15, 20 years, and then you described a number of technologies, and we don't have time to unpack all of them, but are you optimistic at this moment in this transition phase?
Yes.
If VCs always have to be optimistic. Yeah.
Yeah, otherwise I would do something else, definitely. No, everyone tells me I'm too optimistic. They've been telling me that for 25 years. I'm right enough times to continue to be optimistic. I think not every company is going to be succeeding in that space. It may take longer. Something will go faster than others. But I can see this momentum building into what is really the most the highest reason to be optimistic is to see the level of brain power that is being poured into that sector to think about next level solutions in the right direction. It's unparalleled. The people we are meeting more and more on a higher frequency basis is really amazing. So that's what makes me optimistic, because you know, when you have this connected brain power with the type of technology we have under that powers it, between biology, synthetic biology, you know, AI, and so on, it's I cannot tell you about all the projects we are seeing, but some of them are mind blowing.
And the consumer is starting to shift.
And then on the other side, the consumer.
Because somebody has to buy this. Obviously, we cannot just throw it on lower cost and that will be okay, and input costs, etc. I mean,
but if we go back to the very beginning, if you have take the US and you have a mostly private sector health insurance who are going to die. I mean, these companies, these healthcare companies are all going to go bankrupt if they don't do something. They're going to move, and they're going to mandate a number of things. They're going to push people. They're going to push enterprises. They're going to push consumers. They're going to push a lot of things.
You think
to
the health angle is the...
The health angle is one of the big ones. And the, you know, the consumers themselves, the younger generation, who... I think the health angle is going to be the real driver, more than, you know, environmentally conscious people, which are a big minority, but they are not the majority yet. You know, people still think that someone else can take care of that, not them, because they are, busy and they need to take their cars to go somewhere, and I fully understand them. But the health side is going to drive that.
And I want to be conscious of your time and ask a final question, which is never the final question. But if you had a magic wand and you could change one thing overnight, could be in food and ag, could be in general economy, society, etc., what would you change? I have people then say, yeah, we'll change this and this and this. No, one thing. If you could change only one thing overnight, what would that be?
Probably after, I think... There are not one thing to change. That's the issue. It's okay. pieces in the system that need to change, and they all are interconnecting to one another. I would start with the soil. I would give every farmer a magic wand that says, yeah, now I know that I need to take care of my soil differently, and I have this, you know, this new toolbox that doesn't cost me more than before, that I will be using from now on, and that will progressively regenerate the soil I'm on. If you give that to the farmers, they will all say yes, because the land, as David Montgomery, who, you know, I really admire, I've been very lucky to have spent quite a bit of time with him personally, you know, every farmer knows that the land is the most important part they have, the most important asset they have. But if they cannot, you know, if it's too expensive for them and too time consuming to do it, they won't be able to do it. But if I have this magic box, they have this box and now they are putting that on their tractor and it will regenerate the soil over time, I think that's what we should start with. Everything else will then flow through.
And it's also a mindset piece there for farmers that want to, but might not, like the neighbor you mentioned earlier on, might not want to see or are able literally to see that there are other ways. Because if you're stuck in this system for 70 years, it's very difficult and very confrontational to think that might be something going wrong. And to step out of that is for the very few, and the stubborn, the crazy, the etc., and not everybody can be there. So to change the, I think somebody said the most, probably Gabe Brown, the most difficult piece is between the ear, the real estate between your ear to change. Maybe I'm not quoting him right. But, and final question, then I really stop. When you go, I don't know if you go often to like regen conferences, there are not so many, but when you are in the regen crowd, where are you contrarian? This is definitely inspired by John Kemp, who asked that question, like, where do you think differently, or where you don't agree, or where others don't agree with you in your own bubble, let's say. When you go there, what's Where are you contrarian? Is that the machine learning piece or the technology piece? Is the optimism piece maybe, or we need more than a billion to put to work, or VC can work here? But what would be the main thing you said, I'm actually thinking quite differently than a lot of other people in Region Ag and Food?
So,
could be a kind of worms.
No, I think, and again, I invited John Kemp and he came here to Brussels a couple of years ago. It was really fun.
He's a great character. Yeah.
Yes. I think the idea that people, consumers, will actually, majority of them will say, you know, I'll make that purchase decision because of environmental, if it's better for the environment, I'm not really convinced of that. I'm not convinced of that. I think people, I mean, and again, I'm not sure they will make very easily a decision about their health. The big issue we are having, if I stop being totally optimistic for now, for 1 second, is that when you tell people, wow, you're eating really badly, I'm going to show you all kinds of different things, your sugar spike and everything and so on. And people say, oh, okay, well, that's bad. What's going to happen to me? We say, well, in 25 years, you're going to develop, you know, diabetes, or in 35 years, you'll be dying of at much higher rates of some cardiovascular thing. And they say, wow, well, that's bad. Maybe I'll do something in 20 years. And for the next 20 years, I don't care. I'll continue to eat my.
How do we bring it forward, basically?
Fight. So, yeah, people, you know, people have been, I mean, people as animals, you know, we have been wired to be extremely efficient at, you know, fleeing, immediate danger. So we are really good at getting a lot of adrenaline and run. But when you tell someone, you know, stop eating this milkshake every day because, you know, in 10 years or even 5 years, something bad is going to happen. We're not really good at dealing with
climate
that.
Change and sea level rise. Like,
yes.
Stop driving this because in 15, 20, 35 yes. years, maybe.
It's only when people get exposed to immediate issues, so, you know, big droughts, extreme hail that destroy everything around them. When people are exposed to that and they see that it's happening more and more, then suddenly the climate becomes part of the global discussion. But it's not yet on the horizon for. It's starting with water for agriculture, but it's not yet on the food and ag space. People are not yet feeling the real pain. Even if still, when you have 30% of people, or in the Middle East, it's 40 to 60% in some areas of the population who have developed diabetes type 2. When you get past 50%, it means that every single person knows someone around them that has that disease, that came from bad food. They are starting to pay attention. So I think we are just getting to the tipping point, you know, where things are. But when you are in these conferences and where people are trying to convince each other of what they're already convinced of, that's what I'm thinking, you know, maybe we need to think a little bit differently. What are other people thinking?
I want to be conscious of your time and thank you so much, Eric, for having us here and for sharing. And of course, good luck in these challenging times to raise a significant fund. And hopefully a few of the institutional ones will not just, talk is cheap, not just do, oh, we're interested, and oh, but actually follow through, which is way more difficult because you have to jump through. I don't know how many institutional hoops to get it signed, but you have experience with that. So good luck with that. And hopefully we have some nice announcements soon.
Thank you, Kun.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.